BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Davey Scott here, bringing you yet another uncut bonus episode of Classic Scottish Albums from BBC Radio Scotland. In these bonus episodes, we've been letting you hear the unedited interviews I've recorded with the key talent for each album. Today, you're in for a real treat with the original four members of the Delgados, Emma Pollock, Alan Woodward, Paul Savage and Stuart Henderson. We were really feeling the love in the studio, I've got to tell you. It was the first time the four of them had been together for a long time, and there was a lot to talk about.
BBC Radio Scotland.
First and foremost, I think for me that the timeline of this is important because there is a kind of a shift, isn't there, in your approach. Well, maybe you don't think there is, but to me it sounds like there is a kind of widening of the ambition in the music. So where does Great Eastern come in your work and how did you get to that?
I suppose it was the third album, so we had dabbled with strings on the second album. And I think we had just decided that we can do more with that, with this and with that format and just push it more. I think there was a real ambition from the start. When we actually got to the end of the recording, we tried mixing it in Glasgow and we really struggled. You know, we didn't know what we had. And Tony was so involved as well. And, you know, I think we were all quite overwhelmed by what we had and maybe what we wanted it to be and didn't really know how we were going to finish it. So we do have a mixed version of it and from Glasgow before we went to Dave. And yeah, so the timeline was quite a lengthy process from start to finish.
Mm-hmm.
Can't remember when we first started writing. I can't remember what was first.
And, I mean, I never ever really thought of us as being a band that took kind of tangential shifts off in one kind of crazy direction followed by another. Everything seemed to be a very kind of natural, organic progression from what we'd done before. I think Peloton's important in the kind of the origins of Peloton and how Peloton came about and how Peloton ended up sounding. I think is very important as far as the Great Eastern's concerned, because the Great Eastern just seemed like a perfectly natural progression from what we'd done with Peloton. Obviously stepped up considerably. And I also think that the context of the time and what was going on round about then, and I think it's hard to argue the resources that were at our disposal. Still a bit of a boom time as far as the industry was concerned. Chemical Underground had been having a series of successes with Mogwai and Arab Strap, and there was money floating around, and that's not to kind of turn it all into this big kind of mercenary thing, but it, you know, the resources that we had at our disposal dictated the scope that we felt we could try and reach for with the Great Eastern. So I don't think of the Great Eastern as being, you know, a really kind of jarring leap forward from what we'd done. It just felt like a bigger, more accomplished Peloton, if you see what I mean. I don't know, maybe that doesn't do the Great Eastern justice, or Peloton for that matter, I don't know. But I mean, I think really Alan and Emma, because of, you know, the songwriting and stuff. I don't know if you guys felt that there had been any kind of radical shift in that department, or whether it just felt like we were just continuing to write songs the way we'd always written them. I don't know.
But I think for me, looking back at what Domestique was, which was a really busy record from a songwriting point of view, I think. It was almost as if you were so, I was so nervous as a songwriter of space. I was so frightened of leaving any silence behind that we just, everything was to the max. All the chord changes in every song that you could ever fit. And, you know, Alan and I would write apart, but then literally try and join two songs together, which made for the most exciting songs, really. But I think by the time we reached The Great Eastern, which would have been written at the end of 98, moving into 99, I think I'd become more comfortable with space and more and having more faith in a simpler chord progression and melody, and maybe leaving more room for essentially the production that I didn't realise that the band was actually getting involved with, but that's where we were moving to. I didn't even know what production meant at that point. But there was more room for it now than there had been previously. An arrangement.
Yeah, because there's that extra kind of space in, you know, where the writing is.
Yeah.
That songwriting process, Alan, you know, going back and listening to The Great Eastern, it is, you know, there are moments where you kind of go, where are we now? And then, oh my God, where are we? You know, there's a lot of kind of movement, a lot of kind of musical ideas and structural shifts and all that. How does that work in terms of the writing? Because it's credited to all four of you, but how does that work in practice?
Well, all the songs are pretty much written in the same way in that Emma and I would write a song on our own, and then we would come into a rehearsal room and we'd play the song, and then then you collectively sort of rewrite it, some more than others. Some songs will be completely unrecognisable from the song that's brought in. Like the thing Emma's saying, that, you know, for one of the songs in The Great Eastern, we'd recorded a different chorus that we didn't like, so we went in and we rewrote a chorus after we'd finished the record, pretty much. So in that sense, what you're writing, like, personally doesn't really change. I mean, for me, I think that the songs I wrote on The Great Eastern are these. And I had a conversation with someone about this, like, around the time. I had, like, a really young child living in a very small flat. And when I write quiet, I write in 3/4 time. And I think that that's something that completely influenced that side of it. I think that Emma talks about the space in the record, and I think that's like really key, because I think it allows itself, you know, that kind of waltz time. I think it provides for a little more space. You're less kind of firing around the edges on everything, as we were largely in the first two records. Mm-hmm. So from a songwriting perspective, I think for me, that was personally really influential, just having that sense of quiet. And I think as well, like, not to get too far in front, but it for me, it created a massive problem when we were recording vocals, because a recording studio is an entirely alien environment, like, for like, I think even most musicians. I mean, we'd been in and around them a lot. We had our own studio. We'd recorded an awful lot. But when you've been used to doing something in a certain environment, like your house or whatever, and then for us, when we were rehearsing, like, you're not really bothered about the letter. We were so loud that so much of the time, it's like we're constantly using, it's all imagination at that point. It still is, like, the what you come out with from the recording studio is the bones and four different ideas of what something can be. So when we were in the studio and we were trying to record vocals, and they just didn't work, because there was this introspection and subtlety that we had on these songs. And all of a sudden, you've got headphones on in a room with them kind of blaring out, and this created a problem for us mixing. I remember Dave saying this later on, that I recorded my vocals in the live room with it playing in the speakers, because it was the only way I could get the feel of the vocal right. And that's a difficult thing to mix, because there's bleed of the track all over it.
But I remember that for us in particular, I think maybe in comparison to some bands, that, if you like, that middle tier, that middle stage of being in the rehearsal room was absolutely crucial to what was originally two songwriters creating in their own wee world, you know. And then moving into the rehearsal room and almost just giving up the song to the band, which was hard sometimes. I mean, I found that really tough. And watching the song be literally the first thing that Paul and Stuart sometimes would do was just, nah, that's too fast. Or that's the wrong time signature. And you would, it was honestly that the mechanics of whatever we had written was quite often completely dismantled and then put back together in a way that was, credit to the band, much more imaginative than what I had maybe come up with sitting on the couch in the flat. And so that, and then we would discover the energy of the song by playing it over and over again and by getting to know it. And even though I totally understand, you know, what you're saying, Alan, about we did rehearse too loud, but we also created a dynamic that we then reflected in the choice of instrumentation.
So give me both of you, actually, before we kind of widen this out. Can you give me an example of that? That dismantling? So one song that springs to mind. And also, we'll come back and ask you to talk about that song that you replaced the chorus.
Well, it might be the one that it's the same song.
Okay, good. Yeah, so let's talk about that a bit.
Well, I think it's Accused of Stealing.
Yeah, it was.
And I'd written...
That's a beauty.
I'd written a song that was in 4/4 with a chorus that... I mean, it would be fascinating to hear that now, because...
I remember the chorus.
Can you remember the chorus?
I do remember the chorus. I remember the discussion because, as often happens with the four of us, like Paul says, that Emma gets offended. So he had accused your chorus of being like American college rock, and you took the huff on behalf of your chorus. And what was interesting is when we were replacing it with this 3/4 chorus. It did sound really terrible, you know. The one that we used. It was a tough fit.
I went home that night and wrote something that I don't know why I started writing in 3/4, but probably Paul was in the kitchen and he hears it and goes, "No, that could work." And I'm just, you know, ploughing ahead and just trying to find something that sparks, you know, because it is all about that when you're literally with your guitar. And you're trying to find a melody and a chord progression that makes you want to hear it again. It's the only thing you can ever go by. And then, okay, so I've got a thing, let's take it in and see what happens. And yeah, I mean, I can hear that in my head now, that few bars that you merge from that 4/4 into 3/4, and it would have been a real difficult one for us to get our heads around, because I think it might have been the first time we'd ever done that.
It was also done. I didn't know the song. I didn't know that you had written in 3/4. You came in with the chorus in 3, and I remember going, "That sounds really good.
Why doesn't it work?"
It's in 3. How can we do it? And I remember that I think you'd been playing a lot of Nancy Sinatra and Lee Hazelwood. I don't think I had the album at the time, but you used to play Some Velvet Morning quite a lot. And that does that fantastic shift from 4/4 to 3/4, but it keeps the same meter, if you know what I mean, the same beat. So you can still play, if you have a click that isn't accented, you can still play the same thing. So we tried to do it because we'd already demoed this song up. So we had a typical chorus in 4/4 for 8 bars. So suddenly we had to fill it with the same amount of time because it was on tape, and I wasn't one for getting out razor blades and cutting things up. I'd never done that before, so I was like, we need to make 16 bars 4 work in 3/4 time. And that's why the song's got a weird wee tag at the end of that chorus, because it had to fit, because it was the only way we could then demo it to take it into Savar, because we demoed it in Chem 19 in the old place.
So if that song had been recorded digitally, it would have been completely different.
Yeah, yeah. It was a product of the... We literally had that much space on tape.
Wow.
And we had a click. So we're like, right, so that's just got to fit within that time. And there's a weird... Especially the bit where it comes out of the middle 8 section, it's got a really odd amount of bars. that we ended up getting used to playing, because it's just like you'd think it's going to crash out into the last verse, and it doesn't. So yeah, but I remember just going, how did you go away and write a 3/4 song? Did you not think it was?
It's very intrepid, and it's, I'm glad you talked about Nancy and Lee, because I think that's something that, that comes across. I actually think through the whole record and just reconnecting with it, and comparisons are odious, I know, but the kind of the sort of width of the record as well, and the way that you use orchestral instruments, and the way that kind of opens up the narrative a bit. We may come back if you're up for talking about that a wee bit, but just sticking on the songwriting process for a minute and taking it out to you two guys, and the idea was that you would come in and have the songs almost critiqued in the rehearsal room and then almost remodelled, if I'm getting you right, and you said rewritten, and yeah. So what's that process like for you when these songwriters come in?
I mean, I think, you know, Alan and Emma were always incredibly, you know, generous songwriters as far as that's concerned. Don't get me wrong. I mean, we fought like, you know, it could be quite fractious, you know, I think, and quite, you know, you could have quite, you know, songs emerged out of very tortuous processes, you know. And I mean, it's maybe something that's worth maybe bringing around or parking till later on in the conversation, but I think it's also important to recognise around the Great Eastern that there were tensions. There were always tensions anyway, you know, and I think, you know, the label side of things meant that was a constant for the four of us, you know, but there were a lot of things going on, you know. There was a lot of things that had happened over the years leading up to the Great Eastern, and, you know, I know that we all probably individually and collectively felt a degree of pressure going into this record, you know. Mogwai had left the label, Arab Strap the same, and had achieved successes, you know. And, you know, so there was a sense, and you have to be careful, I think, with these things, not to kind of retrofit reality with how you remember. We'll all remember things differently, the four of us, do you know what I mean? But I think that there was a lot of strain, you know, a lot of difficult relationships within the band and everything like that. So all of these things fed into the, you know, the kind of the environment that these songs came together. And, you know, Emma and Alan, especially in light of that, as far as I'm concerned, you know, there is a very kind of special kind of generosity that would allow yourself to sit on your own and write a song and then come in and then perhaps have your perception of where that song should go be undercut almost immediately by someone else.
Yeah, by a new sort of now we're in a democracy.
I mean, I think, you know, it's not to blame Paul, but let's just go with that anyway. I think that was always, and hopefully Alan and Emma will agree with me, that Paul was always the first real hurdle in these things, because I think the first free radical that would tend to get injected into a song is Paul's suggestion of what the drum beat would be, and it was never standard. You know, Paul, I'm dishing out the compliments, but Paul is a very, very creative drummer, and I think there was lots of times where Emma or Alan would come up with a song or bring a song in, and, you know, Paul would say, I've got an idea for drums, and would play it. And they're like, what? You know, Past It Suits You Best was another really good example of that.
Yeah, I've got that on my list to talk about, actually.
In terms of a song that was a series of square pegs that were being hammered relentlessly into round holes. Do you know what I mean? Like, that song was a strange patchwork quilt of, you know, what would seem, in the face of it, to be kind of irreconcilable, you know, kind of shifts in tempo and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of that was down to Paul, because Paul would come up with, you know, at times quite dramatic suggestions for how he saw the drums and obviously by extension the rhythm of the songs going, you know. So I think that, you know, I tended to try and obviously fall into step with Paul, and I think that sometimes, you know, the suggestion of, you know, how the drums should sit, that's kind of, that kind of jars against what you think. That's where I think a lot of the creativity comes from, because, you know, it kind of forces you to try and come up with things. And, you know, it didn't always work, you know, but, you know, often when it did, you know, the songs, I think, were kind of immeasurably improved by it, you know.
So as we're there on that song, right, so, that there's one that opens with you singing filtered right down. I don't know what it is, but it's an amazing sound. And kind of goes over, I mean, 6 minutes 30, is it? Something like that. It's an opening track in an album, right? It's brilliant, right? But it goes from that kind of tiny sound to this kind of gigantic, sort of like massive compression on the drums, almost like shutting down the whole mix of it. And it's epic, not just in its, in the sound it gets to, but in the kind of journey of that. And it seems kind of typical to me of what you were doing all the way through the album. Is that fair?
Well, that was probably why it was chosen first, because it was. You mentioned journey as well, because I mean it was one of the hardest things. Stuart and I went over to Tarbox with Dave Fridman to mix. We took, and Tony was there as well, so the three of us were there, but Alan and Emma weren't around during the mix. And Dave struggled with this one, especially the middle, if you remember. He said, I don't understand what this middle is about. And I was trying to, we were both trying to sort of come up with ideas like how to convince Dave that this song made sense to us, but he didn't quite get it. And he was always really kind of keen on, like, what's it about lyrically? What does this word mean? What does this line mean? So we had to email Alan and Emma a few times during the mix just to say, like, Dave's asking. And I remember you talking, you sent something about the parts that suits you best. We'd try to articulate the best that we could, but I think you must have sent something, or we spoke on the phone. And I kind of knew it was about a journey or a struggle, and we tried to articulate that with Dave. But there was some elements of that middle section being a musical play of some sorts, of like being like a struggle and a fight, and then the end being the result. And we talked about Tom Waits, what's he building in there as a kind of vision for it, you know, like that idea that it's like, it's not just a song, it's a play. It's like, that's got sound design in it and stuff like that.
And dialogue in the lyric, you know?
So
there's that kind of, there's layers all the way through it of that.
So Dave was like, this hasn't worked for me, I don't understand this middle. And we were like, this has got to be like an idea of like a play, like a struggle and stuff. So we just started looking for stuff that we could record and add to it. And we just left a mic on somewhere, and we all marched around the studio and made noise. And Dave Fridman started picking up weights and hitting them. And this was in the just weird noises. And we also had a camcorder with us recording our most ridiculous drunken nights out. And it was the bit, the dialogue in the middle of it is from the three of us coming back from a night out. Just stupid stuff. Right. But it gave it an atmosphere that was missing, and that Dave really wanted. And then when he finally, I remember him just going, right, I've got it, leave me alone. And that's how he would mix. We would just leave him to it, and he would go and work his magic. But he had to have a lyrical connection and a reason for that section, because he was all for like, why don't we just chop this 3 minutes out of here? You know, like,
why do you need it? There's a great challenge in that, isn't there? And it's funny to me to listen to you guys talk, even all these years since you made that record, there's still a memory of conflict, positive conflict and maybe more challenging conflict there as well. And it seems to me a big part of what you did and what you achieved with the music.
Yeah, I mean, I think listening back to everybody, it's a really fortunate truth that we were all quite challenging in personalities towards each other. but in a really positive way, actually, even though it manifested sometimes with you know, as Stuart has talked about, a fractious environment. But honestly, this record and the records that we made, I mean, goodness knows whether we would have got past album one or two if it had been easy going. And, oh, that's lovely, Emma. That's great. Well, we just put it down. You know, I mean, it really was that necessary questioning. Justify it. Justify what you've done. Because a lot of the time, I was just blown with the wind when it came to songwriting. I was just going with how I felt. And I don't know how else to put it, whereas I think that the rest of the band were incredibly good at lifting the lid and asking why and how should this be portrayed.
Okay, so we're started talking about the recording process a wee bit, and we'll come back and talk about some other songs as well later on, but again, it's interesting listening to the record that some kind of, you know, remove and just thinking about that kind of sculptural almost collage thing that it has. How much of it was recorded like that in the studio? How much of it was, I mean, you've already talked about some of the stuff you couldn't cut and paste, but was there any cut and paste there? Was there any sort of big edits in the recording, or was it played like that?
Just the whole album. the album in its entirety.
Okay, that's a comfort to know that.
God, there was lots of edits. I think when I mentioned about the cut and paste we couldn't do, it was due to my skills as an engineer in our studio. Tony was much more adept at that kind of thing. And by then, I think we had started using clicks and a mixture of tape and Pro Tools at the time. It was a really weird hybrid. So when Stuart and I went over and with Tony, with the parts for the album, it was like we were loaded with stuff. We had 9 2-inch reels, which weigh a ton. We had like 2 or 3 hard drives, SCSI drives, zip drives. We might have had some other little formats. I think we had a few DATs and mini discs. It was like ridiculous. Like, and we dumped it in Dave's table and said, "There we go, that's our album." And first of all, on night one, when we arrived at night, and put the drives down, Dave said, "That's not my drive. My drive won't accept that format. I don't know how I can do that." I can't really remember. I mean, I should know these things. I'm supposed to be an engineer, but Tony just went, "Okay, have you got a screwdriver?" And he opened up this drive, and he did something. I don't know if he sold or something, but he like managed to. Because me and Stuart were looking at it, going,
"Oh my God,
is our album going to happen?" And he kind of went, "Yeah, there you go." And Dave went, "Oh, yeah, that'll work." I just didn't understand. So it was like, you know, we took, it was everything, and it was very pieced together, but from quite an organic start. It was one of the first times I'd used click tracks, so I had to learn how to do that. And then grew to love it because I could then go, "Wait a minute, I can do that again." You know, that was helpful.
It's another thing that reminds me again of filmmaking as well, though, that sense that you can shoot all this stuff or record all this stuff, and then there's a distinctive editing process that somebody else maybe takes a bit of ownership of, you know, and maybe get. So was there a sense that Dave Fridman was able then to edit this down to the benefit of the overall concept of the thing, or what exactly was his role, apart from the technical stuff of getting that done? What else did he bring?
But it always struck me as really, really funny that the songwriters weren't there. Yeah. That's the thing I keep looking back and thinking, what happened there? You know, how did we make those decisions? I just remember, you know, Alan and I would be sitting in Chemical Underground's office waiting on a mix to be sent through so we could listen to it and then write notes. And it was the right thing to do because look at the record that it became, and we're all, you know, really proud of that. But it is really interesting that we couldn't really afford to have all four of us go over, and we had to make a decision on who went over. But I was delighted with that, really, because I've always felt more confident in handing things over to those who I trust can develop them. So
Did you have the same feeling? That's something that...
Honestly, I don't remember. A lot of the things that we're talking about just now, these are all new to me because I've forgotten them. I'll be completely honest, but I don't even remember hearing mixes.
Yeah.
I vaguely remember the thing about Tony and the about to break the album.
Yeah.
I like that. That's honest.
There was a mix that came through where it had been affected to such an extent that it almost felt as if the original song had been buried.
Was that not the next record?
Fallen record.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I remember that.
Okay, I joined Alan's club.
Yeah, to be honest, I always felt you were a founding member of my club, Emma.
All right, there you go. Yeah. Thank you very much.
That's definitely going in. Okay, let's get back on to sort of a slightly firmer ground and the songwriting thing, because in the middle of, for me anyway, in the middle of all of that kind of, those sonic ideas and the kind of sculpture and the way that the thing sounds, I still hear two really distinct, certainly just very distinct melody writers in there. I think, Alan, your songs always have that very, very sort of like beautiful simplicity and often quite big hooks, you know, whereas you have that, you know, really, really very specific approach to writing melody. Emma, tell me if I'm speaking a lot of rubbish, but I hear it anyway in the Delgado's music and in your own music. Is that something that you're aware of? Is there a way that did you influence each other as songwriters in that respect? Or
I'd honestly never thought of it, and like, has it been different? I've never seen the difference in what we produced, I suppose, because I'm viewing it all as a whole. So it's maybe easier from the outside looking in, I would imagine.
I think I do recognise that Alan's songs sometimes came in with more obvious space, even though I've already talked about that, even with respect to my own writing. But I do think Alan was a lot more comfortable and confident with that idea of letting something linger harmonically, whereas I was still probably reeling a wee bit from the idea that if I didn't fit as many chords in as I possibly could, then it was somehow a failure.
Yeah, that's not what I meant, by the way.
No, I know that, but I guess I'm just, from my point of view, I'm just talking about the fact that I sometimes do feel like it's almost as if I rush through some kind of harmonic movement when it's not necessary always.
I remember. Sorry.
No.
I was going to say, I remember one of the songs on the record. So this is like coming in from previous records, and you know, Emma would always, like, her songs would be very, very chord heavy. There'd be a lot of chord changes in them, you know, often, you know, possibly, you know, I don't know what you were overcompensating for or whatever. You knew more chords than me. Alan knew the four. You perhaps knew seven. But I remember when I played American Trilogy and thought, oh, it's better not be a square go because it's only two chords. The entire song's two chords. Then it goes to E minor at a couple of points, and I thought, is this going to be looked down on? Is this going to be second class citizen because it's only two chords and we've got Emma with the chord machine in the corner?
But what's amazing though is that I listened to that song quite recently and recognised that it's the same chord progression for the verse and the chorus.
Yeah.
Which for me is something that I always think is a really, really impressive thing, because it's what a lot of classic pop music does, that you manage to reinvent something by rewriting a harmony and, sorry, rewriting the melody and the rhythm of the melody. And I'm sorry if it's getting a bit academic, but I do find that really, really impressive, because it's something that I guess maybe I haven't really, in that part, hadn't maybe had the confidence or faith to do.
Yeah. You started to talk about American Trilogy, and that's one, and again, we can maybe get on to some of this kind of arrangement, which is such a feature of this record, and that ends with this kind of like epic kind of string arrangement, or it's all the way through it, really. So you worked with string arrangers on this. Was it Greg Lawson did the strings? How did that work? Did Greg come in?
He was one of the string players. Mainly, I would say the main string influence was Alan Barr, and by, I'm not sure by that point, Charlie was Charlie was heavily involved.
Yeah.
Alan's closer because Alan lives up here. Charlie is based in London. But when it came to the record, Charlie and Alan were crucial, and Greg was a fantastic person that came in. And Alan was cello and Charlie's viola, so we needed a violin, and Greg provided all the violins. He was incredible at that, and working with Charlie and Alan and kind of realising that vision. But I think a lot of the demos and stuff was, a lot of time it was just us with Alan Barr.
So tell me how that works. I'm really interested in string arrangements. That's something I kind of do, and that's something I would do very sort of, that's like a kind of monastic process for me, is the writing string parts. So was this collaborative? Are you in the room actually kind of singing ideas for strings, or?
No, I remember that was happening. I think Stuart, you too.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's just, you know, I suppose that, you know, the thing for the four of us was that none of us really were technically trained in music in terms of, I mean, I know Emma, and certainly now, I think obviously Alan and have more ability to kind of like read music and all that stuff now, but back then we weren't. And you know, I think like most bands, God, like most things in life, I think we were kind of quite, there's a kind of rich kind of seam of serendipity that kind of ran through everything that happened with us. And again, you know, it's maybe worth just pointing out, just anecdotally if nothing else, you know, taking it back to Peloton again, you know, the kind of relative kind of success of Pull the Wires from the Wall, we were asked to go on the Jack Doherty show on Channel 5, and John Peel was on it, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And,
was it? Yeah, I think so.
We had to find string players to mime to the song because we didn't know any, and we had Alan, and we went down, and it was Dave. It was Dave Russell.
Dave Russell, I think.
Knew Charlie, or somehow knew someone who knew Charlie, and he got this guy, Charlie Cross, to come with a couple of his violin friends based in London to come on at the Jack Doherty show and not play their violins on the telly. And as a result of that, we became friends with Charlie and Vuk, who I think was anyway, to cut a long story short, you know, that was how we ended up, kind of, because the Delgados, if you like, certainly as we kind of went through Peloton and into Great Eastern and onwards through Hate, became this, you know, kind of modular kind of ensemble that would sort of, you know, kind of swell and then get smaller or contract as required. And I think that we were very lucky, really looking back on it, very, very lucky with the personalities that became part of our kind of larger family, if you like. You know, Alan Barr certainly was a constant from the beginning, and his attitude, his musicality, his whole attitude to, you know, his place within the band and how to kind of put music together, Charlie the same. You know, we found out a lot as we went through those two big symphonic records, if you want to call them that, Great Eastern and Hate, that it's really, really critically important that you have people, especially people who are very well trained classically, that those people have the preparedness to do the simple thing, you know, not to overcomplicate things, not to resist when we suggest that the most impactful thing for the song in this particular part might be this relatively simple pad or whatever. And, you know, we were very lucky, you know, and I think about it often, actually. I look back on the individuals, the people that we worked with, Camille Mason, another very key part, I think, to the sound of the Great Eastern and Peloton as well. Camille, Alan and I went to primary school with Camille, and I bumped into her at a bus stop pre-Peloton and told her that I was in a band and asked if she'd maybe be into coming in to the rehearsal room and doing stuff with us. And I still, you know, it's a digression, but in terms of, you know, you look at the steps along the way that brought us to the Great Eastern, I still remember that day in Hamilton at MCM when Camille, you know, did, you know, knocked out that flute part for Everything Goes Around the Water and stuff, and just how, what a moment that was in terms of like just the softness of the flute, how the melody just was completely transformed, and just how that went on to change the sound. And I think Peloton, if you like, was like an album almost like with kind of stuff, the strings, it's almost kind of quartet-y kind of strings that we did with that. And then when we came on to the Great Eastern and Charlie was on board and Charlie knew Greg, you know, and Greg came and Alan, and I remember that night again for me, I've maybe got it wrong, but this is how I remember it, so that's all that matters. one of those key kind of game-changing moments of the Great Eastern was the night that we started laying the strings down for American Trilogy. And it was Charlie and Alan and Greg, and they went in and did the strings. And then they went in and did the strings. And then Greg came out and says, we'll do them again. I'll just octave it up. And he went in and did that four times. And then he said, right, then I'll drop it down a bit, I'll do another one. And we just did it. And I remember sitting in the control room just listening to this string section, this just get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Just that was the total jaw-dropping moment where I was just like, wow. Do you know what I mean? This is like, right, this is where this album's going now. You know, and I think that was the thing for me.
I think that, you know, I love that because I think sometimes you can think of string arrangements or any kind of arrangements as being sort of an adornment, you know, which can also be nice, you know, when you hear a sort of pretty string arrangement. But this, they do add weight, don't they, in this particular record, and not just weight, but darkness as well, and kind of threat or something like that, I don't know.
We never wanted pads. I mean, we didn't really know what pads were. We were all about melody lines initially, because that's how we spoke to Alan when we were saying, right, you know, it would usually be Alan first, and it would be, here's a part, whether it's Alan or Emma's backing vocal part or guitar part that they don't think they'll be playing anymore. Here's an idea. Or Stuart would come up with something and say, could you do this? And then they would run with it, and then... But it was all forged out of lead lines. I think that's really crucial. It wasn't formed out of chords. We never ever went into them and said, here are the chords. We always just allowed Alan and Charlie to sort of say, well, I could find a harmony to that. And the harmony was never really overemphasised, I think. I think we were mainly full of hooks.
Yeah.
String hooks.
See, at the risk of talking about the wrong record, so Malcolm Lindsay wrote the introduction, really jaggy.
To the wrong record.
To the wrong record.
That was, the next record.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking
that
honest, as well.
To be honest, see my memory of the band, it may as well just be a five-album album, really, because at the end of the day, my memory of it is that is a classic example of what you've just talked about, because the intro of that song, which name I can't recall, was so important because it almost sounded as if it just was never going to fit.
Yeah.
So that lack of knowledge, hopefully, made us treat strings as if they were a guitar.
Yeah.
Or a vocal. And we forced something that was other out of it rather than simply complementary.
Beautiful example of that on that song, Knowing When to Run. You know, that kind of little flurry thing. You were talking about Nancy. Am I wrong?
No, you're right. But that's a sample.
That's a sample. Is that
terrific? That Rimsky-Korsakov put
it, because I was going to say it's got a John Barry thing about it. That's a sample, is it?
That's a sample. Yeah. And there's an opera singer in the background. It's a sample as well. I think that song wasn't sounding great, and it really needed like something that was quite kind of pedestrian. And I was listening to Scheherazade, and we just sampled a bit of this old recording of it, and a thing from Berlioz, Les Nuits d'Et, and it just brought the whole thing to life. It's weird how things like that
And it was a weird time because we had some pals that were in a band called Iri and Jaya.
Oh yeah,
and Doogie and Chris, and they took a lot of these things and sampled them for us, and kind of like were able to sort of give us these. I think it was that was the zip discs I was talking about. These little bits and pieces, and go like, that's the BPM that will fit over that chorus. So they were really handy. I think we did sub bass and samples at Doogie and Chrissy's.
Yeah, I remember that.
In their living room.
Yeah, so effective on that track. And of course, there's contra, because it's actually quite bright in a way musically, that piece. But the song itself, Alan, is a darker kind of...
It's pretty grim.
Narrative, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk about that wee bit.
Well, it's... it was an article in a magazine called Antiquity, and it was about the use... So I studied archaeology, and it was about the use of archaeologists discovering and being able to prosecute a guy who killed his son. And that's, you know, it's a bit kind of dark or whatever, but that's... You know, I think sometimes as well when you're around this time, I'll have like a kid who's 1.5 or something like that, and just that your personal circumstances and how they influence your worldview, and you know how someone's able to, you know, do something like that is it's not that it's morbidly fascinating, but I think sometimes these are important things to try and sort of document lyrically.
But the thing is, you're writing about things that are maybe not always written about. I think that's one of the things that makes it distinct, isn't it, as well? There's a kind of breadth of topic or what you're writing about. But there's also... Sorry, carry on.
No, I was just going to say, I think actually the fact that we were two songwriters and there wasn't a single voice or lyricist that represented the band, I think meant that you weren't going to get the straightforward love song, for example. Not necessarily. It would be pretty disguised if there was one, and possibly quite barbed in places. But I think we did want to you know, write about things that were maybe quite unique, because our voices were equally heard, and I don't think we were ever trying to represent anyone other than... Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is it's difficult when you're one of two songwriters. It's you can never represent the band on your own. You never should represent the band on your own. I think that changes the way you approach a lyric.
Yeah, there's the real example of it now that we're at the back end of the album, not just in that change of voice or approach or whatever, but also all of a sudden we're back to quite a sort of you know, the last track on the record, Emma, where we hear you and the piano and just another couple of instruments. Was that a deliberate move to do that, to close it in that way?
So that was Make Your Move.
Make Your Move, yeah.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, it did feel like a closer, and it was a song that was quite a personal one about... I think it was basically about just my mum had been adopted, and I think at that time I was thinking quite a lot about how difficult her kind of early years had been. She only found out when she was 18, type of thing. Or she only met her mum when she was 18, really, was what I meant to say. And it was, I guess, yeah. It's a song that fitted at that particular time. But again, was really, really well shaped by the guys in the band.
I thought it was when we're writing songs, we get to a point where, like, we don't know what's going to open it and we don't know what's going to close it, but I think it is a really, like, really beautiful, understated way to finish a record, which can at times be quite sort of intense and full, and just to end on something that's the sparsest song on the record's it felt really nice, really right.
I think the past that suits you best was one that we had figured was... I think we'd talked about it before, and the past that suits you best was the one that we all thought was the closer. And when we got all the mixes done, and it was more of a statement of intent to put that one first, which would have been another great closer as well. It would have worked in the sense that here's the album tied up in the most bombastic and ridiculous way, almost like distortion and compression, and their string section that's feeling like it's going to explode, and I mix it sound like it's exploding. To put that first, which is a real challenging song, it was a definite sort of decision that we all had to make and think. It's not an obvious thing, but it lets people know, like, what this album's about.
And again, my recollection of that was that you were kind of at the vanguard of the idea of starting the album with that song. And I think it, you know, I think pretty quickly, I seem to remember that we kind of swung around behind that idea and you recognised. And I think, you know, you mentioned it about it being a really bold kind of statement of intent, and that was important for us. Kind of touches a little bit again of what I'd mentioned earlier on about the pressure that I felt some of us were under. I know for a fact that I remember giving an interview around the time of the Great Eastern, and, you know, again, maybe all four of us were all in slightly different places, do you know what I mean? But I remember talking in an interview about the time, or at the time, thinking that there were certainly moments recording the Great Eastern that it felt like this is our last record. You know, we won't, this will be it. And I remember reading somewhere, and I remember mentioning it in an interview or something. It was like someone interviewed Martin Scorsese or something like that, and they talked to him about Raging Bull. And they were like, that, Raging Bull, black and white, like that film, and like, well, what were you thinking? And he was like, he said, it was absolutely 100% certain it was the last film I was ever going to make. And I just threw absolutely everything at it. And I felt at that time, again, with us, that there was this sense of that there was nothing was going to be left out, that we kind of threw everything at this record. And the idea of having The Past That Suits You Best as a kind of starter was important. But there was a symmetry there as well. You know, I think that the introduction of The Past That Suits You Best and then the outro of Make Your Move, to me at least, certainly kind of like had this kind of sine wave of a record that kind of started with a single note and ended with one, and everything in between was just all this other stuff. So, you know, it's the serendipity thing again, isn't it? You know, you kind of, through the chaos of pulling these songs and this album together, you finally get yourself into a situation where you, by luck or judgment or whatever, you tweak it here and tweak it there, and you end up with the final product. And, you know, you look back and think, well, how could it have been any other way? Do you know what I mean? But it's never quite as assured as that ever.
Yeah. I mean, the tour for that was probably like 13 people.
That was the height of the personnel, you might say. You know, going to America, Canada with us.
Is that when we ended up having 14? A wrestling competition in the Blue Peter Garden? Was that that record?
Presumably.
That was after Jules Holland, yeah.
Was that the Great Eastern, though? Yeah.
We sacked the violinist of the, was it the Royal
Philharmonic Orchestra?
Philharmonic Orchestra.
We were doing something at this, where was it?
Royal Festival Hall.
And because it was a big gig and it was a big room, we decided we would bring in some extra musicians. And there was just a couple of violinists who were being really disrespectful. Like, one of them in particular was bowing the wrong way. So, and he'd had a couple of beers, and we'd kind of, afterwards we were kind of chatting and sort of said to our tour manager, like Stevie Dredds, he said, look, like, maybe he shouldn't come back tomorrow. And so Stevie went and sacked him. Felt really good about it as well. But, yeah, there's a lot of people involved in the tour, and it's interesting because although we played some really big spaces, which was great, but it's also really nice being with like 13 people on a kind of small stage in Bristol or whatever as well. It was really kind of quite something quite punk rock about it still.
Yeah, we never made things easy for ourselves because we touring with it. Well, obviously the album had strings all over it, and the easier thing to do would maybe to get a keyboard player to emulate it.
Yeah.
And there was always a kind of thing, there was a thread running between us and maybe I would say Mercury Rev to a certain extent, because the reason that one of the reasons we loved like a lot of flutes within distorted guitar music was, you know, Mercury Rev, and Dave Fridman was in Mercury Rev, And I remember Deserter Songs coming out, and we heard it first. We got a copy from someone. We had a link with Dave, basically, after Peloton. He'd heard our Peel session. He'd somehow heard our Peel session. And he told his manager to get in touch. And his manager got in touch at the end of Peloton saying, Dave really likes what you're doing. Would you like to work with him? And we said, we'd love to, but we can't afford it. And we went through the process of recording the Great Eastern, tried to mix it and didn't get anywhere. But by that point, we had used our connection with Dave to get Mogwai involved with him. So we knew the process. I think Stuart was heavily involved in dealing with Dave's manager, Peter. And so working with Dave came about through that connection of Peloton. But there was always that kind of, it was maybe this thing about Mercury Rev and, you know, and for a few reasons. Dave, flutes, and the third one that I remember was seeing them live and being gutted that this massive album, Deserter Songs, was being played on a keyboard. I thought, you know, no offence to them, you know, because I think they made a fantastic album. But I think the presentation live was always something that we all said, no, we can't do that.
Yeah, let's hear the music like it is.
Yeah.
Let's never get royalties ever again.
Yeah, yeah. Let's
lose money on every tour.
Yeah,
well, I think I think that was the thing. I think, you know, and again, it's not to bring up other bands or whatever, but I think, you know, context is everything. And I think, you know, with Chemical and with Mogwai and Arab Strap as examples, you know, these were bands that were, you know, quite, that were, I'm trying to think of the right word, but they were radical bands, you know, and Mogwai and the way that their music was, Arab Strap, and the way that they, you know, their lyrics and everything like that. And I think, you know, I don't know, I think that we were I don't know, modest is not the right word, we were modestly radical. We were radical in quiet ways. And I think the kind of, I think it's easy perhaps now, in terms of where music has gone and the type of records that people can make now, it's easy to forget just how I'm not going to say important, I don't mean important, but just how different it was for a band like ourselves to produce a record that was as symphonic, if you want to use that word, as the Great Eastern was, with the resources that we had, to try and make a record of that scope and heft. You know, I think that was a big thing, and I think, you know, that we tried to take that on the road with us and play it live, despite the fact it was not the path of least resistance. You know, it was more difficult for us to do it like that than not, but we chose to do it. And I think, you know, I think that was the thing about us, was that we kind of, you know, we never really shirked the difficult decisions with these things, even though it maybe made our lives a bit harder. But it was always felt like it was worth it.
To be fair, I think, you know, I recognise a lot of that process during Great Eastern and Hate, down to the way that you were always the one that would say, can we do it even bigger? Can we get it even, can we push it even further? And it's not a surprise that you keep on bringing up the pressure from, possibly, like, we all felt the pressure of running a label with Mogwai and Arab Strap on it. These were our peers who were doing some of, you know, the finest work that we'd ever, you know, our contemporaries were doing some fascinating work. And here we are in the middle of it and being the bosses to a certain extent, you know, through the label, and always being felt like we're third place. We're never going to be first. And it was like this. There was that drive. You know, there was that drive for us to like, no, we can do what, you know, as relevant an album as, you know, Young Team or Philophobia. So there was a real kind of like, we're going to make this record and we're going to make it, you know, as unique as we can and explore every possibility. So that, you know, I remember that Stuart's mantra almost throughout The Great Eastern in Hate was more. You know, people said that sounds huge, right? Can we push it further? Then, not like, oh great, it's huge.
Yeah, beautiful. It seems like an apposite way to close. Thank you.
BBC Sounds.
Yeah, it was really great. Special, actually, hosting that reunion for the Delgados, and hilarious that some of their memories were muddled up with other albums they'd made. I sometimes thought we were making a programme about Peloton. If you're enjoying these bonus episodes, please give Classic Scottish Albums a review and a rating on your podcast app. We love hearing what you think. We're interested in your suggestions for other albums we could cover in future episodes. Next week, it's Fun and Games with Neil, Tommy and Graham from Wet Wet Wet. I'm Davey Scott. Thanks again for listening.
BBC Radio Scotland.